Susan Kolb, and welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. Today we're pleased to have with us Dr. Alan Hamilton, who is a neurosurgeon and the author of The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope. Hello, Dr. Hamilton. How are you today? Alan.
I'm just fine, Dr. Cole. How are you?
I'm good. I have your uncorrected manuscript for limited distribution, so I know
I know that
you may have some changes in here, but that's the one I have. I just wanted to say that to begin with. But I really enjoyed your book. It's really refreshing to have a colleague in surgery have some insight into the consciousness, the looking beyond our third dimensional existence into the lessons and growing compassion and the things that we came here to learn. And certainly surgery offers being a surgeon offers a juxtaposition, because when you're a surgeon you're in one form of mind, but then when you become a patient, as I've been a patient many times, you switch to the other side and then slowly you begin to balance out the two. Your journey becoming a surgeon was quite interesting.
You mean it wasn't a traditional course to
not at all.
Medical?
Would you like to share with our listeners how that your quest to avoid getting drafted led you to becoming a surgeon?
Well, I sort of got done with college early, and at that time the Vietnam War was at its height, and there was a lottery. And in the lottery, if you got picked, you got drafted. And if you could find some reason that you weren't eligible, then you could get out of that. And one of the things that I looked at was certain research jobs. And I just happened to luck out with a guy who was, of all things, interested in birds of prey. And they were using them to try and clear up birds on the runway.
Mm-hmm.
Of jets. So this was like funded by the Department of Defense. And I got involved in this project, and one of the things that interested me had to do some surgery on some animals for the project.
Mm-hmm.
And then I left college, and we were in the middle of a recession at that time. So I couldn't find a job, and I actually took a part-time job as a janitor.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't make ends meet, and somebody had advertised that they wanted what we call a kennel boy, which is the person who cleans up all the cages and the poop and everything else in a veterinary practice. And because I had janitorial experience, I obviously was very qualified.
There you go.
So I took the job,
uh-huh.
And as I was mopping and cleaning and everything, I could see them doing surgery in the
mm-hmm.
Animal suite. And I got more and more interested and did a lot more mopping right outside the OR. And finally, the veterinary surgeon, I said, well, if I change the time I do my chores, could I just hang out here? And he said, yeah, okay. And eventually he just got so tired of me standing there that he finally said, well, look, let me teach you how to scrub in, and you can hold
mm-hmm.
some retractors and help
right.
me. And that's sort of what led me to want to be a surgeon.
Well, that's great. And, basically, your book tells different patient stories, but each one has, a message and a very interesting, progression of events. Would you like to share some of your stories with our listening audience?
Sure. I didn't start off wanting to write a book about spirituality.
Right.
I sort of feel like I'm a hardcore surgeon, and this wasn't what I was setting out to do. But because you're a scientist and things happen with certain regularity and certain patterns, you're sort of forced to say, well, let's consider what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the very first like watershed events for me was I was in Africa. And one of my jobs was I was to go out and immunize children in villages, and you couldn't get to them. There were no roads, so the only way you could get to them was by river during the wet season, when the river would be high enough that there'd be all these channels to these distant villages. Excuse me. So in order to get there, we had this this sort of boat. They called it. It was a dugout. It was really a log with a little wearing blender motor at the end of it. And we packed this up with all the gear that we were going to need for this immunization, expedition, if you want to call it that. And we were ready to go. And during the night, we had our dugout tied up so we could set off first thing in the morning. And the river rose so high, it actually washed the dugout away. So when we came down in the morning, it was gone. And it took us all day to find it. And we had to redo the whole outboard, and we put a new outboard on. So long story short, we repacked everything. And so now after this delay, we finally set down the river. And as we go down the river, we realize this river has risen so high that the landmarks that the guides would normally use to tell us where to go on the river are pretty much abolished. And one of them is there's a big fork in the river, and the large fork goes to the Atlantic Ocean, which is not where you want to go in a dugout.
No, definitely not.
And the other fork, the smaller one, is the one that leads to the village. And my guide didn't remember if it was left or right or north or south, whatever you want to call it. He just said, it's very obvious. It's a big channel on one side, very small channel on the other. And as luck would have it, because of the high rains and everything, when we got there, they're exactly the same size as far as we could tell. And we were really very concerned and decided to crash land on this in the middle of the fork because we had no idea where we were going.
Right.
So we pull up there, and we're completely lost. And I look up, and there's this beautiful, handsome African native gentleman with just a pair of shorts and a huge mane of beautiful gray hair. And I said, boy, am I glad to see you. You know, we're lost. And he kind of looked down and chuckled and said, yeah, I can figure that out. And, I got all puffed up. I was out of Harvard Medical School. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm here to immunize children and vaccinate children. Mm-hmm. And we need to get to this particular village. And he laughed. And he said, well, that's why I'm here. And I said, what? And he said, well, I had a dream that you were lost. Mm-hmm. And in the dream, it told me that I had to come here to the fork in the river and wait for you to leave
such
this village. And he said, but the really strange thing is the dream told me to be here yesterday, not today.
Right.
And I'm just thinking to myself, well, there's no radio, there's no phones, there's no cell phones, there's no smoke signals.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just struck me. I mean, here I am in the middle of the African jungle. My ability to carry out my job is completely dependent on this perfect stranger who has to have so much faith in a dream that he comes and waits, and not just that, waits 24 hours.
Right.
And then I began to say, you know, the world may not just work by the rules of science. There may be some other things going on here that I don't appreciate. So that was a big one for me.
Yeah, I had just finished interviewing on I've actually interviewed him twice, but last week I interviewed him for a second time. Irvin Laszlo, Dr. Laszlo, wrote a book called Science of the Akashic Field, The Integral Theory of Everything. And as I went through your book, I just went back to his theory, because actually the theory, and as all theories, needs to be tested. The theory of the Integral Theory of Everything would certainly explain that, in that the person who was guided by his dream was actually assessing or accessing a portion of the Akashic field via the dream state, and the information that he was getting was probably a little delayed, in that your mishap with the boat getting out from under you, that information hadn't been transmitted yet, because it probably hadn't happened yet. And so it's interesting to relate all of these things back to some theories of consciousness that actually could put everything together.
Yeah, I unfortunately at the time, and I guess maybe even now, I'm sort of a doubting Thomas, and I just sort of sat there and go, this isn't really happening. This can't be happening to me. And yet, it was. And in Africa, generally, life can be explained and is understood by a set of rules that are largely dependent upon supernatural interpretations. And we don't. We live in a world that we tend to think from a comfort level is run by the rules of science, by rules that have already been verified and are empiric. And in Africa, they lived by a set of rules that were basically quite related to supernatural powers and omens and taboos and curses and all sorts of spirits and that sort of thing. And it was a real eye-opener that there could be a completely different language, if you will, but that it was just as fluent.
It's actually an expanded world because they live in a multidimensional world and we live in a unidimensional world.
Yeah.
You know, in our world, if it isn't within the walls of the time-space continuum we're in, then it doesn't exist, or you're crazy, or, you know, you're weird, or all those other things that people say. But in actuality, the science is there. If you combine quantum theory with super string theory, as Laszlo and some other consciousness researchers have, it's all quite scientific and quite explainable. You know, the existence of consciousness after death, which actually your story in the book about the woman who was totally brain dead
with the aneurysm,
with the aneurysm is an example of. But I interviewed Dr. Russell Targ, who is a laser physicist who did the $20 million worth of research for the remote viewing program. And
right,
he
that
shared,
was incredible research. I mean, people don't understand the significance of what that found, but you know, a lot. Just so your listeners kind of get a grasp. I mean, when I looked at the results that originally came out of the Princeton Center for Advanced Sciences, there were a number of people. Number one, they had started working on people and seeing if they could affect the outcome of a random number generator. And what that is, it's like a computer that flips a coin, and it either comes up a one or a zero, and it's done at random. So what they asked people to do was, could you try and affect the outcome of the computer, meaning make it make more ones or more zeros? And there is a group of people who, without question, statistically have a significant effect on the outcome and can change how a computer works.
Right.
Now you can imagine the Department of Defense was pretty interested in that because this was at the height of the Cold War. So they began to select these people based on these abilities and actually got involved in remote viewing and had picked a number of very recognizable targets, if you will, things like the Eiffel Tower or the Golden Gate Bridge or the Taj Mahal or what have you. And they would ask these people, they said, we're going to assign you a particular site, and we want you to visualize the site. It'll be a photograph. We will have photographed it, and we want you to draw it as best you can. And we're going to put that picture in an envelope. We're going to put that picture in an envelope, and we're actually going to put the envelope in California, and you will be in New Jersey. And then you will be asked to look at what's in this particular envelope. Now, the interesting thing was they were able to figure out what was in the envelope, but they were actually asked to do it a day before the actual envelope randomized. So they actually had picked the photograph that was going to be randomly given to them a day in advance. So there's definitely some, and these studies are highly scientific. And so they're pretty amazing. I think they tell us that the universe is working in a number of different ways, and for most of us, myself included, we're pretty deaf to this language. You know, I always think about it, you know, this way, you know, like I go for a hike, and I walk, and I see trees, and I see mountains and bushes and what have you, and I come, and up behind me comes a great photographer, like somebody like Ansel Adams, and he's seeing the same, before he died, he would be seeing the same thing, but suddenly he was seeing all this beauty and majesty and composition and symbolism and that he would grab in his pictures. And you'd say, well, what's different? And what's different is his eye is different. He's seeing the same things I am, but he's seeing far more in them than I see. And I think in a lot of ways these what we call supernatural things that we can't explain, that they're really just a question of we're not tuned into the way the universe speaks to us most of the time.
And I think most people aren't aware of the advances that have been made in physics either, because physics actually is the language of description that will allow one to understand the various states of consciousness that become multidimensional. You know, all of us have the experience of deja vu. All of us have the experience of feeling somebody's presence in the room that may have passed over, or many of us, maybe not all of us. I don't know if you ever, I wanted to share with you a story that Dr. Targ shared on the radio show. I don't know if you've heard it or not, but I wanted to tell you this story because of the story in your book about the patient. Why don't you go ahead and just explain that story, and then I'll tell you the experiment
the
that Targ did.
Or the burn kid?
The patient that was totally brain dead and yet recalled all the conversations in the operating room.
For this particular procedure, she had a blood vessel in her head that was very,
right.
that had ruptured and was difficult to repair.
Right.
And we decided that the way to do this would be very much like you sometimes hear in the winter where a kid falls through the ice and he's,
mm-hmm.
You know, is down, submerged, not breathing, no heart rate for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they pull him out and revive him. So for this, we put her on a heart-lung pump and we cooled her body down and eventually stopped all blood flow to her heart, all oxygen delivery.
Mm-hmm.
And we have this period of about 20 minutes where we can operate in this window where there's no
right.
blood, no oxygen delivery, and we have electrodes on the brain that show it's no, there's no electrical activity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty tense there for a while until you're sure you're going to finish the job before the clock has run out. And we did. We had plenty of time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's the OR is no different than any other place where we work. Once the tension's off and everybody feels successful, there's a kind of a lighthearted spirit in the operating
mm-hmm.
room. And everybody started chatting. And, you know, there was one nurse who started telling us a story about, you know, her engagement over the weekend and everybody doing and eyeing and everything else. And then this procedure's going well. We start the heart-lung machine back up. Her heart starts back up. She's doing well. And I go to visit her in the operating room and the intensive care unit afterwards
mm-hmm.
to make sure if she's recovering fine. And she's doing great, but she says, you know, I remember this conversation. I said, really, what? And she says, well, it's about this person, and they're getting engaged, and they bought their wedding ring at this particular store. And she remembered every detail
mm-hmm.
of this conference, the restaurant where they went, the waiter had tripped over her fiancé when he got down on his hands and knees. She
right,
knew where they
right.
So, and I'm going back and looking and thinking to myself, wait a minute. Her brain had no oxygen. Her brain had
mm-hmm.
no blood delivery. I had electrodes on her brain showing
mm-hmm.
she's got no electrical activity. We know in neuroscience you can't make a memory if you don't have electrical activity in the brain. So then the question, you know, arises, well, okay, where were these memories made? If they weren't made in her brain, it's not possible
mm-hmm.
for her brain to make those memories. They had to have been made in another consciousness that wasn't
mm-hmm.
in her brain at that time and somehow came back with those memories. So it was, for me, you know, I guess about as close as I'm going to get to the Holy Grail of finding a consciousness separate from the brain, but it was startling because, you know, and I actually showed her EEG recordings around
mm-hmm.
To a number of experts, and, you know, I just said, oh, this is a patient where
mm-hmm.
we think his brain dead, and, you know, we just want to make
mm-hmm.
sure, and they would look at the recording and say, no, absolutely, you're brain dead, you don't have a thing to worry about.
Right.
So I was,
right.
wanted to just make sure that, you know, there was no evidence of any possible electrical
mm-hmm.
activity. So she really kind of defies explanation if you don't accept that there's some kind of conscious entity that's separate from brain activity.
Well, that, and as all of us in the OR, from, you know, the text to the anesthesiologist, we need to remember that the patient can still hear us when they're under, and so we need to be respectful of them.
I leave a sign on the door of my operating
right.
room that
yeah.
says patient is awake,
right.
even if they're not, because
exactly.
When we do surgery on awake patients,
mm-hmm.
everybody's very careful what they say, obviously,
right.
because
right.
they assume the patient can hear everything. So I just leave mm-hmm. those signs up
right.
so that everybody
That's
thinks they're
idea.
Walking in on an awake patient.
Right.
And I think, you know, the things that I had one patient that I sort of had blended into the story of the other one where I was operating on a brain tumor
mm-hmm.
and fortunately a benign one. And as I was operating, I was looking through the microscope and talking to my resident, and I'm looking down and I go, uh-oh, this is going to be really bad. This
yeah.
is not
yeah,
this is gonna be bad.
Yeah, right.
And the lady did fine, and I saw her
mm-hmm.
in the ICU, and she said, how are things going? I said, very well.
Mm-hmm.
And then she said, well, how come during the middle of the case you
said
something?
You said,
I never go back. And I was like, oh, this is the last time I'm ever going to sputter that in the microscope again.
Well, I thought it was, but I was wrong.
Yeah, right.
Well, I wanted to share with you Dr. Tark's story. There are many researchers, including Gary Schwartz and others, who
right,
are researching
right.
the idea of does consciousness survive physical death? And many of them are based on information. And there's a lot of, you know, in the parapsychology world, you know, you're wondering if it could be telepathy, or there's other explanations for information. So Dr. Targ decided to do an experiment based on something other than information. So they had a medium go out into the world where mediums go, which are not in this dimension, and find a former chess grandmaster who, at the time when he was alive, was second in the world. He was Hungarian. Mm-hmm. And through the medium, they played a current grandmaster. And it took several months because the medium didn't know how to play chess. But they went and did 60 moves before the Hungarian lost. And Bobby Fischer was Russell Targ's brother-in-law, and Bobby looked at the 60 moves and said that only a chess grandmaster could have done that. And the Hungarian said that he would have done better, but he'd been dead for, you know, 20 years. So, and he had a messy middle game. This is interesting. He had a messy middle game in life, and in this game he had a messy middle game. I mean, I don't know if you play chess, but I guess you can have a messy middle game.
Yeah.
So that used a skill that would be much more difficult to have it be something else other than true proof of the survival of consciousness after death. So that would lead at least some support to your experience of having the patient remember.
We have an annual conference on consciousness. It's very scientifically oriented. That's run by Stu Hameroff out here in Tucson. And
mm-hmm.
I have to say, most of the physics that these guys talk about and gals talk about is just like way over my head. You know, but when you start to get into the world of physics, you begin to understand that it is just as quote-unquote supernatural as anything you could possibly imagine.
I think it's more supernatural.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with
there's
you.
There's a lot more in that physics than that is predictive. That's what's so interesting. It actually predicts things that all the anomalies that are occurring.
Well, and then you say, well, okay, if this is so crazy that I can't even imagine how out there this is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just watching a program on black holes and information, the ability of information to be retained at the edge of a black hole. And,
right.
You know, suddenly they came up with this theory that, actually Stephen Hawking came up with this theory
mm-hmm.
that there are, you know, an infinite number of parallel universes, and information is preserved because the ones that have black holes destroy it, and the ones that
mm-hmm.
don't maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how the universe maintains information. I'm going, what? You know, that's how the universe retains information. I'm
mm-hmm.
I'm going on the edges of a, and it's smeared out over infinity on the edge
mm-hmm.
of a black hole. So I'm like sitting there going, this is just so far beyond my ability to comprehend and imagine.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, like everything else, I think if you went back 3,000 years ago to Greece and the
mm-hmm.
ancient civilizations, and you were trying to explain what every one of us accepts now, you know,
iPod,
and, you know, cell phones,
right.
And,
yeah, right.
You know, remote controls.
It would be like magic.
Right. They
to
would
them.
They would go, this
yeah.
is completely beyond our ability to
right.
To comprehend it. So I think it's going to be the same way with a lot of this. You know, 3,000 years from now, it'll all be explainable.
And I think we need to be respectful of people's personal experiences. As a physician, I know that you've encountered what I've encountered, and that's that when people, when you tell stories that are within your own perceptual reality, and I mean, they happen, there's no question, you're not making them up, you have no reason to make them up. And when people question other people's perceptual realities, they're assuming that everybody's perceptual reality is at the same point. Well, it simply isn't. Like you said earlier, the African that you met at the fork in the river lives in a totally different perceptual world than you do. Completely.
And
his survival may depend on it. I mean,
absolutely. And then you get down to the fundamental things of prove that the red that I see is the red that you
right.
see.
Right. And a neurosurgeon should, I mean, that's neuroscience. You know,
right.
That's in the field of neuroscience. Those
questions. Well, I always get to these kind of brick walls sometimes with people about personal
uh-huh.
experience, because I think personal experience, whether or not it's validated by objective experience, is very real. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, you or I have personally experienced it. It's pretty hard to deny.
Right.
And even in medicine, when you talk to surgeons, as you know, an anecdotal experience as a surgeon,
mm-hmm.
if you have one bad experience, one disastrous experience in surgery,
yeah.
it doesn't matter if the literature says you can do this 1,000 times
right.
and it will only happen
yeah.
once. You are not going to do that again.
So we're superstitious.
Right. We're very superstitious. And
we claim not to be.
And we very much are moved by personal experience.
Right.
You know, so I always, you know, get to this point when they
yeah.
talk about, well, we don't have objective evidence and
yeah.
blah, blah, blah. And I go, okay, how many people in this room love somebody? And, you
yeah.
know, every hand goes up.
Yeah.
I said, prove it.
Right.
Are you saying the only way you can prove that you love somebody is if I do an experiment where I put that love person in a street and I have a car coming, and the way that I test whether
you
love them is, are you willing to jump out? And 99 out of 100 people are willing to jump out. I said, that's not what happens. I said, you know if you love somebody.
Yeah.
And that knowing is plenty of evidence for you. Plenty of evidence for me. So I think there's plenty of things in our lives where we go, if I know it, that's all that matters.
Yeah. I tend to look at things that happen, the anomalies in life, as guideposts. I've had a number of very, very bizarre experiences, starting out with I was agnostic in college, and I was in my dorm room, and I looked up, and there was this golden light, and I looked around, and there was a 7-foot angel behind me, I mean, in the physical. You know, and I became very frightened, and I didn't speak.
Especially
and
coming into your dorm, right?
Oh, yeah, no, right beside me. And the energy was tremendous. We weren't in the third dimension, I can tell you that. I think I was raised up into another dimensional, you know, area, because it didn't feel like the third dimension. It was not a dream, and I wasn't on drugs. But it completely shifted me.
Uh-huh.
It shifted me into a realization that I needed to study consciousness. Because I couldn't deny the experience, and
right.
I went to a couple of clairvoyants in my life, not that many, but every one of them started out by saying, you know, your guardian angel came to speak to you and you were too scared to listen, every single time, you know, so that's the first thing that comes. And I said, yeah, and then I was interviewing Doreen Virtue, who is an expert on angels, as you might know. She has a lot of books on angels,
mm-hmm.
and she said, oh yeah, you protect the underdog. I do a lot of work with women with poisoning from silicone and
mm-hmm.
biotoxins from saline breast implants. So I tend to go up
that.
Against some multinational corporations on that. And she said, well, yeah, you protect the underdog, so you actually have two male warrior class guardian angels because you need them. So really what happens is whatever our life path is, we're provided the protection. You know, we're provided the intuitive skills or the logical skills because they're different sides of the brain, and we need both of them. So I believe whatever happens, even if it's really weird, and I've had some very strange things happen, I ask why they happen, and then of course I'm given a lot of information, and then I can understand why this path. And it's great to know that we have a lot of support from the universe, or whatever you want to call it, consciousness. We actually are very, very much protected, and everything along the way is actually a blessing. I fell and broke my arm in 06, and I was interviewing the lady that was taking over, Sylvia Brown. She wrote a book called Remembering the Future, and I told her, you know, I broke my arm, I was off for a while, and she said, oh yeah, you were going to get cancer. And I knew I was going to get cancer. I could feel the cancer forming in my own body. But of course, I wasn't going to do anything about it. You know, I was like, I was going to like ignore it, as most surgeons would do, you know, just completely ignore that. And because I rested, and because I was off work, and I ate well, and I took care of myself, it's dissipated. It's no longer there. I didn't have cancer, but I was energetically on the verge of it, if you can
understand. What I don't get is why, I mean, we've all experienced, particularly in medicine, there's, you know, there's definitely something about facing a severe illness or major surgery that sort of brings about, you can call it a vulnerable, you can call it a susceptible state. I mean, I think, you know, the patients in those situations are far more reaching out spiritually and emotionally for support. So they're in a very, you know, they're like a radio that's really tuning into the station kind of thing.
So we
see this all the time in medicine because we're in this unique, privileged arena, if you will. And yet you have the we have the hardest time talking as colleagues in the open about it. You know,
we have to be tough. we're invincible, you know, and bulletproof.
Well, but, it, you know, and it's like we're scared, you know, and then you go, well.
Well, we're scared of not being able to do what we do. And as you point out in your book, being a surgeon isn't like being a writer. You can write even if you don't have a voice and you're a quadriplegic. I mean, you know, but being a surgeon requires you to have your a whole bunch of faculties, including your vision, the ability to stand for long periods of time. I mean, just all sorts of things that could be taken away, and so we're vulnerable.
Well, and, we're vulnerable, but we're not even, you know, in the middle of the night. You see somebody who's, you know, is dying. All of a sudden, you know, the numbers start turning around, and then you find out that there are a whole group bunch of people were praying for them at that exact moment, and you go,
I can feel that energy. When I have my own operating rooms, and when a whole church is praying for a patient, there's actually a shift of energy in the operating room. And I often go back and ask the patient or the family, I said, did you have a whole bunch of people praying? And they'll say yes. And so, like in your book, you can discern that yellowish change before people die. I have the ability to sense energy when the prayers are coming in, because it's a great spiritual energy, and things actually go very smooth.
Well, I always think, one of the guidelines that my teachers have, my patients have taught me is that, I love when people ask me to pray with them, because I sort of feel like, oh, great, we're going to tap into this energy together. And the other thing is, there's no surgeon in the world who's really a good surgeon who doesn't appreciate the fact that they could use all the help they can get
really.
To make the surgery
because we are superstitious.
as you know from the book, I'm very superstitious. The worst thing in the world you can say in my operating room is, I think this is going smoothly, because I always feel like, you know, you're going to curse us as soon as you say that. So I just say, no, you can say we're very grateful that things have gone so well.
don't make predictions.
But be humble.
Well, Norm Shealy said that he didn't want to take care of anybody who had less than 6 weeks to live, because I really wouldn't change. I thought that was a good one. But tell our audience a little bit about your experience, like when I fractured my arm. My life had to shift somewhat. I was operating ungodly number of hours, and so I had to slow down, and that meant that I was able to write a book that I'm about to, you know, about to be published.
Congratulations.
And do some, thank
What's
you.
What's it called?
It's called The Naked Truth About Breast Implants, which is
wonderful.
But you know, it slows you down. It changes the course of your life, and always for the better, although you don't know it at the time.
Right.
You know.
Well, you know, in my case, I had originally badly damaged my back in Desert Storm. I had fallen down a staircase. And it had a number of fractures, compression fractures, and my spine sort of healed with a little bit of a curve, but I felt okay. And then about, let's say maybe 11 or 12 years later, I was riding a horse, and this horse threw me and actually broke my back. And of course, it was terrible. I was in the process of getting paralyzed when they rushed me to the operating room. Then, you know, there was 10 hours of surgery, and I lost half my blood volume, and I'm in the intensive care unit.
So things didn't go so well.
Right, and I'm in the intensive care unit, and you can sort of tell by looking at your colleagues as they're visiting you that something has not gone all that well. And basically, as I was starting to recover, my surgeon said to me, you're never going to operate again. you'll never be able to stand at the operating table. And, you know, people don't understand that, you know, you're sometimes standing for 10, 12, 14 hours at a time.
Often.
Right. So
I don't have that many cases under six.
Yeah, exactly. And so you know, this was a terrible blow to me. I mean, I spent most of, you know, I spent 17 years of training. We come and go to med, you know, pre-med, go back to pre-med, do med school, and, you know, 10 years of residency, because back then they were infinitely long. And, you know, now it was gone. And I was devastated. I mean, I just did not know who I was anymore. I mean, my wife would tell me, you're my husband, you're the father of our children. But but when I woke up in the middle of the night and asked who I was, I had no answer. And I got very, very depressed and even got suicidal about it. And then, you know, I started thinking about, well, what do my patients do? You know, what did they do when all of this was happening? Because suddenly I'm a patient.
Right.
You know, I'm one of these people. They try and put you on the plane early. The grocery boy asks you, can he carry your things out to the car?
Right.
You know, everybody's trying to pass you on the escalator because you're too slow and all this stuff. And you know, I said, what they do is they reinvent themselves. And you'd better, you know, buck up a little bit and figure out what you're going to do to reinvent yourself. And to do that, you really need to reach out for spiritual and emotional support.
Right.
You know, the universe has to be out there ready, and it's always ready when you're ready. It's not, you know, and at that point, I just said, I got to find something that I can really do with everything that I've learned. To not just to be of use, but to really save my soul. So, you know, we put together a big think tank that looks at medical errors, because I got sick and tired every Wednesday morning of listening to this long litany of terrible mistakes that were happening to people, and basically decided that I would devote the rest of my life in medicine to the issue of how do we train people so that they don't make mistakes on human beings. And
which is very important.
Yeah.
Learn from other people's mistakes.
Well, learn from other people's mistakes. Practice. I mean, we don't ask pilots. You know, I was thinking about this guy who went down in the Hudson River and did such a heroic job. You know, you don't get on the plane and say, okay, so how many times have you ditched this plane in the water, you know, or how many times have you crashed like a plane just like this 747? Because I need to know what your experience is. And the point is, they've crashed it hundreds of times, but on simulators.
Right.
So, you know, we are here at the university. We built the largest center for simulated tissues. We can make, you know, we can set up a surgery so you can remove a brain tumor. We can make it bleed. We can have people practice until they get it right. And what we find out is, if you practice surgery in a simulation situation, you'll go down to the operating room with a 35% lower rate of technical mistakes, and you'll operate about 30 to 40% faster.
Well,
so that's those are all good things.
They are.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. And that's a new technology that is really, I mean, until recently wouldn't have been possible.
And yet, when you go, I'm fortunate. We have Davis Monthan Air Force Base, which is where I went to see how they trained pilots. And you know, the thing about a pilot, a jet pilot, is the A-10 jets that they fly out here, there's only one seat. So when you go up and fly, the best that your instructor can do is fly next
talk to you.
But if you make a mistake, you know, it's a big, expensive, potentially fatal one. And when I looked at their training, they knew everything that their pilots had learned. They had simulated everything that could possibly go wrong. And I kept thinking, why aren't we training people like that in medicine?
That's a good thought. I spent 13 years in the military, and I spent a lot of time with the fighter pilots, including going to the simulations at McDonnell Douglas. And the F-15s actually did have two seats, so the trainers
did. Yeah,
that's
the two-seater, right.
Yeah, but, you know, so I'm real familiar with the simulation. And,
well, I remember I asked if I could jump on the simulator, and the first thing that happened on the simulator was one of the one of the lights on the panel went out, and it said that one of my two engines was out, and I completely panicked and augured in within a couple of about 30 seconds, and then later I asked the pilot, well, what are you supposed to do in this situation? And he said, you panicked. It was just that the instrument light was out, and all you had to do, you're supposed to flick the switch back and forth, and you were just so.
What about listening to see if both engines were running?
What about all those cues that I could have used, like, you know, the plane wasn't falling over to one side and all that? But I panicked so much I crashed the plane. And so, you know, he said that's the kind of thing where, you know, after a while it'll become reflex. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that I always find interesting training resonants is I always tell them you really practice good medicine from the gut, not the head.
Mm-hmm.
Because when things are wrong, really wrong, you're not going to have chance to think. If you have to
think
about what's right.
No, you don't. I was in the ER when we had a fire, and something took over me, and I ripped everything off the patient, even though, you know, we still had a wound there. Fortunately, it was a small wound. It was on the lip, and it wasn't any big deal. But by ripping everything off, the oxygen, which had been fueling the fire, the patient had mustache wax. And it had caught fire with a Bovie, and you know we presented it at the case you know the M&Ms and all the other surgeons said we do that all the time, we don't know what happened, but I found out later it was the wax that caught fire, because hair really doesn't catch fire, as you know, it singes, but it doesn't catch fire unless there's grease or wax on it. And but you're right, something takes over and you just simply whatever took over was just perfect, because the patient had, you know, more superficial second degree and not third degree burns, which could have easily happened, or an explosion with the oxygen, you know.
It's funny, I look and I've lectured a lot about what are the differences between, for example, the aviation or the nuclear regulatory industry and medicine. And in aviation, for example, there's a national database. And all incidents get reported because, you know, if something goes wrong with the wing of one airplane, there may be thousands of airplanes out with the same problem.
Right.
Well, we had a fire in the operating room that was related to, we were actually doing a subdural, a chronic subdural, and so it's a small procedure in neurosurgery, but you, you know, basically they were cleaning the scalp and they had prepped it, and they'd used an alcohol-prepped wash.
Right.
And it just so happened that that spark was enough, because the alcohol was completely dry, that it combusted.
It pools often. It'll pool somewhere.
Right. And it was impressive. We actually went back to the lab and reproduced it. And you can actually get online and watch, look for that OR, fire in the OR, and you'll see it. It's horrifying to watch how fast it just goes up in flames.
Yeah.
But when we looked, there wasn't a national database. It turned out that this had happened in dozens of operating rooms.
Right.
But
it
hadn't been reported into a national database, so each one of us was sort of dealing with, quote-unquote, an isolated event when it wasn't at all.
Right. And you could educate people just simply not to use the alcohol-based
preps.
You know? It's like,
it's gone.
Because of
that risk, but you know, it was just amazing when we went back and looked and found all these other isolated cases, and you go, how long was it going to take us to find out about this?
Well, yeah, and surgeons are also isolated amongst themselves. I mean, even though they may share stories, sometimes it's fairly unusual for surgeons to share their misadventures, other than in the privacy of the M&M conference. You know, they don't
think about them very often.
You know, it's like the ego gets in the way. I'm not going to mention that I was present during an OR fire. You know, it's
when I was the chairman of surgery, I got this phone call. I called in, you know, I usually if I was on a trip, you know, somewhere in the country giving a lecture, being a visiting professor, I'd call in every day. And I'd say, you know, what's going on in the hospital? Everything okay? So that particular day, my administrative assistant said, oh, nothing much. We just had one patient burst into flames in the operating room. And I said, no, seriously. He said, no, seriously. It really happened. And so we really did a very thorough investigation of what happened. But I just remember being so shocked that that their patients' drapes had actually burst into flames like that.
Well, they've done studies on OR fires, and often it is a complete surprise to everybody in the room that there was even a dangerous situation there. So this database would be really important to share with everybody.
Well, I think, now that we're looking at things like Medicare not paying for certain complications, I think there's going to be sort of a heightened awareness because guess what? Now people are incentivized not to have complications,
right,
finally.
Exactly.
And there's now this expectation more and more of, guess what? You can't just write this off as, well, this happens during surgery.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain amount that is going to just happen because of the odds, but at the same time, this heightened awareness is really driving much more vigilance and scrutiny. And one of the things I've been very amused by is that it's not very high tech. A lot of the things that change complication rates are washing your hands very thoroughly, not breaking sterile technique. When I talk to lawyers about medical legal issues, and, I say if there's one piece of advice that you could give doctors to help them avoid lawsuits, what would it be? And they say, slow down.
Yeah.
Take your time and be a real doctor and slow down and talk to patients.
Mm-hmm. And also slow down in surgery. We have the younger residents seem to have a hurry disease. And I tell them, you don't have time to do it right, but yet you have time to do it over. You don't understand. You're going to get sued because of these hurry mistakes.
And the other thing, we do a lot in my think tank center. It's called Aztec, the Arizona Simulation Technology and Education Center.
Mm-hmm.
We do a very, very sophisticated computer analysis of surgical movement.
Mm-hmm.
And we can basically, with a kind of a weird application of fuzzy logic, which I won't go into, but basically the computer can weigh different factors and then tell you if somebody's a beginner, intermediate, competent, or an expert. And the thing that distinguishes the experts from everybody else is not their speed.
Mm-hmm.
It is the quality of their movements. They're very smooth.
Right.
They're actually slower,
mm-hmm.
but they're incredibly efficient.
Right.
And there's far less movement off the trajectory. There's far less acceleration, deceleration. And so when we look at what makes a good surgeon, it's actually the economy and the smoothness and the stillness of their movements, not speed, not being flashy. And I think sometimes when the residents first start out, they really misunderstand that really slow, careful surgery is the fastest kind of surgery.
Well, and you don't have to do things over because you didn't make an error in judgment of, the big errors, like cutting too much off the pedicle in a breast reduction or, I don't know the equivalent in neurosurgery, but there's just certain things that if you slow down during the most important part of the case, and there's always that most important part of the case where the wrong move, and sometimes it's just really small, could really screw up your day. And, you got to know when to slow down. And also, I think what I try to teach people is how to be intuitive. And when I'm interviewing surgeons, I kind of throw out some questions to them, like, do you ever get a sense that you're close to a nerve that might be not in the right place? Because as there's with the peripheral nerves anyway, they can be not where they're supposed to be.
Right. They don't always get to see the anatomic diagram first.
Right. And we make our incisions usually in the same places to approach certain things. And if the nerve happens to be there and you're going too fast and you don't think it's there, that's when you get, that's when you cut the median nerve or when you cut the, or cut into something that, and you know when you do it, it wasn't supposed to be there, but it was there. So, you have the intuition to know to slow down,
right,
because you're going to encounter something that you don't know is there. I had a vision going into work one day. I have these visions. They're really weird, and people say I'm crazy because I have visions, but I actually do have visions. And it was a flash, and in the flash was a surgical field with a hernia. And I was going in to do a tummy tuck that day, and the patient hadn't had any previous abdominal surgery, and the hernia was above and over to the left of the belly button. And yet when I got into the surgical field, when I approached that area, there was a hernia there. And as you know, if you go too fast, you could go right into through the hernia sac and into whatever
bowel.
Was under there, including bowel.
Right.
And so I get questioned all the time about, you know, these visions. You know, whenever you're giving depositions, the attorneys will go in and say, do you see visions? And I go, yeah, you know, they're protective. You know, I see things that I'm about to, you know, they're protective. I don't know where they come from, but let me tell you, they're protective, and I'm glad I have them, you know. So
well,
that's why
an incident. I was driving to work and get going in the morning for the OR, and there was this, living in the desert, there was a dead jackrabbit in the road, and there was these two buzzards that were sitting right next to it, kind of shredding it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's one of those images, you go, oh, my goodness, drive on. And I got into work, and I'm getting ready to start the OR day, and I had this patient we were bringing in for brain surgery, and I went to say hi to him and his wife, make sure everything was ready and let them know I was there, and I said, I'll see you in the OR, and they're getting ready to wheel him behind, and the wife leans over and gives him a big kiss and says, don't you worry, my little bunny, everything will be all right.
Oh.
And I'm going, all the hairs in the back of my neck are
standing. Yeah, I know.
So I went out to the front desk, and fortunately the charge nurse there was somebody I knew really well, and I said,
yeah.
Look, don't ask me why, but I want you to change this guy on the schedule
right.
and put him later in the day.
Day
and you know, we'll
right.
just make something
yeah.
up, but just do
yeah.
me a favor. And so I moved him around, and I took another case to the OR first. And he had a heart attack a couple hours later. And, you know, fortunately, he was in the post-anesthesia care unit at the time. He was fully monitored. They rushed him up.
Much better than if he'd been under
Yeah,
anesthesia.
I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
He's in the middle of brain surgery.
Oh, yeah.
He's going to
have
a heart attack.
That would be real good.
He's going to know it. He's going to die. And
yeah.
then turned out, this guy made a full recovery and operated
right.
on him about eight
yeah.
weeks later. But
yeah.
if it hadn't been for that little bunny,
that's right.
I'm not
that
sure. He would have had a heart attack right in the middle of brain surgery.
That's right. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour, but I want to thank you very much for joining us. I really did enjoy your book tremendously, The Scalpel and the Soul. We've been interviewing Dr. Alan Hamilton, who shares some really delightful stories about his own spiritual path as well as the patients he's encountered along the way, and has some great great advice at the end of the book, the lessons learned and how we should look at life. Next week we have, Keith Amber, Stay Centered in the Middle of Chaos. That's something that some of our surgical colleagues could benefit from.
Yeah, we all need to do that.
Really. And then on the 11th, we're interviewing Dr. Andrea Rosenoff, the magnesium factor, as well as talking about Penta Water. And then on the 18th, we're interviewing another neurosurgeon. I don't know if you know Dr. John Turner. He's in Hawaii, Medicine,
yes.
Miracles, and Manifestation.
I've actually read his book, and I actually
yeah.
wrote. I wrote a review for him.
There you go. Great.
Yeah, it's a good
it,
book.
It must be a new world when we have two neurosurgeons who
yeah.
are spiritually aware. I think
we're
that,
about
I think
to be
we're,
thrown out of every professional organization there is.
We must be at the end of an epic or so, or epoch, or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, you know, the others will follow. Don't worry. But it may
oh,
take
I,
several
I know
lifetimes, they but they will follow.
Right.
They
sometimes
can't help
being
but
the pioneer
follow.
Is bloody.
That's right. One of my friends said, "I've been bleeding on the cutting edge for years." I like that.
I love that.
And then on the 25th, Danyon Brinkley with his book Secrets of Light, Lessons from Heaven. Danyon has had multiple near-death experiences and is a very entertaining viewer. And then we have the Noetic Science meeting we have every week. Every month. This is Thursday, July 16th. Dr. Dave O, that's OU, will be talking about consciousness and healing, a medical doctor's journey as a patient and practitioner of holistic medicine. So anyway, I really enjoyed our time together, and hopefully we can do this again. And if you're ever in Atlanta, we would love to show you
the
center and maybe
have
you talk at Noetic Science.
Regularly. This was the CDC and the American Cancer
Society.
Right,
great. Well, look us up. We have an operating room with four ORs and then an integrative medical practice associated with that and a cancer clinic. So we do a little bit of
that. Well, I love the work that you're doing and helping women with these problems that in a lot of ways we created because
yeah.
a bunch of men were running the medical, you know, devices and not really looking at them carefully enough mm-hmm. with the implants.
That's right. If you don't do the studies, you can't find out the problems.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll see everybody next week. This is Dr. Susan Cobb, Temple.
I'm sick and tired of always feeling sick and tired, and I don't want to take a lot of prescription drugs to feel better. Isn't there a better way?
Millennium Healthcare offers natural solutions to your health problems. Millennium Healthcare is qualified healthcare professionals working with you to restore your health and wellness. Whether it's a caring physician, one of our natural providers, or our natural apothecary, Millennium Healthcare can help. For more information, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012.
Don't you just hate trying on bathing suits? Wait a minute, you look great. Plastic surgery?
Not surgery. I got an endermology treatment from the experts at Plastikos.
What's endermology?
Endermology is the terrific non-surgical treatment that Europeans have been using for years to tone skin and contour the body. Endermology by Plastikos feels great, and you can see the difference it makes.
No kidding. Who do I call?
Plastikos, a leader in plastic and reconstructive surgery, is the number one center in Atlanta offering endermology. For more information and a complimentary consultation and treatment, call Plastikos at 770-457-4677. Plastikos Endermology Skin Toning and Body Contouring, 770-457-4677.